Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Happy Monday, this March 11th, 2024. Welcome to the Compliance Guy Auditing, Coding, and Compliance Roundtable with Stephanie Auer, Christine Hall, Terry Fletcher, Scott Kraft, and our good friend, our compadre, the guy who adds so much meaning to these conversations. Paul Spencer is on a cruise ship with a bunch of 1960s, 70s, and 80s rock and roll bands or country.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
It is.
I didn't know that part.
I know. I'm being a hater right now because I'm jealous. But I did serenade the girls with an old Julio Iglesias song today.
That's true.
See, if you were part of the panel of the Compliance Guy, I'd be serenading you with Julio Iglesias music as well.
Oh, the things they miss.
So Scott's back from Japan, and he was talking about the karaoke over there, and you know, kind of interesting, but I think we have some interesting topics for you all today. So let's go ahead and jump straight in. And where do we want to start? Do we want to start with the cert, or do we want to start with collaboration agreements?
Let's start with those agreements.
All right, let's start with collaboration agreements. And I think this is an area where folks really need to pay very close attention, because there are so many gotchas. There's so many compliance traps when it comes to these collaboration agreements. And remember, each state is different. So,
and Sean, sometimes the agreements are different for NPs and PAs, and there's limitations on some of those things. So
I agree wholeheartedly. Absolutely. Significant difference between what a physician assistant versus what an FNP or an ARNP or an NP can actually perform. And it's really interesting, because I got an email from somebody after our podcast a couple of weeks ago, when we did the whole Incident 2 thing, where they had tried to bring up about a certain type of nurse practitioner. And I actually went back through and had to share with them that you can't just say nurse practitioner, because depending on the type of certification that they have as a nurse practitioner could mean the difference between doing this versus doing that. So, you know, you always want to make sure that when you are getting ready to render an opinion on something, you're getting ready to write a policy on something, make sure that you don't just do a superficial layer review of information. Make sure that you drill all the way down as far as that guidance will take you. And again, I'm not saying that the person who emailed me was wrong in any way. They weren't. It just went deeper than saying a nurse practitioner. All right. So with that said, Terry, why don't you go ahead and kick us off with the collaboration agreements, and then we'll fill in the gaps where we need to.
Okay. Well, I wanted to shout out Decision Health Part B News, because they sent out, you know, they sent out their weekly newsletter, I guess it's called. And I share the content with the team here. And it was interesting, because we've all heard of contracts, you know, between employee contracts, things like that. But one thing that I think is important for our listeners is that once you get into clinical providers, and we're talking about providers that can bill directly to a payer, and that you're using them in your practice as a mid-level or as an extender, we're not talking medical assistants or, you know, people you use to take blood that also file insurance claims. We're not talking about that. We're talking about our mid-level providers. When you use nurse practitioners, PAs, clinical nurse specialists in your practice, you have to have something that is generally known as a collaborative agreement. They are also, you know, called services agreement. I think New York has something called a supervision agreement. They're called different things, but in the general sense, they're called collaboration agreements or collaborative agreements. What these are, and let's make sure we understand them, they basically say that the main physician, okay, or the directing physician, the supervising physician, and we're not talking about incident two, but the clinician, the physician is taking responsibility for anything that is being reported or billed and performed under that mid-level provider's licensure. And now it could extend to the physician's license. And some states, I know Florida is different than where I'm at in California. I know Georgia has some weird rules. They're weird down there. But again, we've met Sean. You know, there's just some things that are going on, you know, that you have to know your state. And so they, and for example, in my state, if they're going to prescribe medication, you actually have to put the exact medications they're allowed to prescribe. In some states, it just says they can prescribe Schedule C or whatever. And so what this article basically said in a nutshell was that the risk that you've invited and the lax of really understanding your agreements or not having them in place has not only made losing the license susceptible to physicians, also the mid-level providers. But one thing that providers or physicians forget is that once that mid-level nurse practitioner PA leaves your practice and you didn't inform the, you know, the board that they've left, you're still responsible for them because that agreement's still in place until it's not. And so there's just so much to unpack on this. And actually, Scott, I'm going to start with you because I know you've probably seen them and dealt with this, and I deal with it more on a surface level, because all of a sudden I'll get one of my clients that'll say, Tara, we have a problem. And I'm like, oh, great. Let me see which attorney I can refer you to, because you've got an issue. What are you seeing when it comes to collaborative agreements that's a problem? Because I know you're up in Oregon.
It's always been on my radar screen, but when it first really got on my radar screen was during the pandemic, when people began to practice more independently. In some instances, this even included nurse practitioners and PAs who wanted to go out, like, sort of quote, on their own, or to do work on the side. And they needed these collaboration agreements in order to see patients. And, you know, these agreements carry all manner of things that may not have been updated for technology. I think it was Missouri where the supervising physician had to be geographically located within a 30-mile radius of the nurse practitioner or the physician assistant at any point in which that provider was rendering services. And so they could have somebody substitute in that role if they needed to, if the collaborative physician was going on vacation or something like that. But that needed to be the case. And so I find that, you know, when I get these questions, and Terry, I think you spoke to this, and Christine a little bit as well, oftentimes there's a different level of scrutiny or supervision required for a nurse practitioner versus a physician assistant. I don't want to generalize. I think there've been a number of states I've looked at where the physician assistant requirement tends to involve a little bit more scrutinizing by the supervising physician, not necessarily always the case. But I think they also require, you know, certain amounts of documentation review, certain amounts of feedback, depending upon the state. And so, you know, I think it's important to understand, and I think the article that you referenced explained this very well. Like, you know, these things tend to get signed and you don't necessarily think about it really. You think of it as like a thing I have to have. And I know that, you know, another thing I learned talking more specifically about the independent NPs is there are sort of serial collaborative supervisors out there, I guess I would describe them as, who enter into a number of these agreements. And so, you know, whichever end of the agreement you're on, you need to make sure you understand, specific to your license, what's required. How are you memorializing that work is being done? If the supervising physician, or I say the collaborative physician, needs to review 10 charts a quarter, how can you prove that activity occurred? And those are the types of things where you don't think about it until somebody comes in and says, well, you know, let me see that. Right. And as we, you know, we talk about documentation on this podcast every week, and the way that you prove something happened is you memorialize it in a record somewhere that you can produce on request.
Before you move on to Christine, cause I know I want her input. Just one thing that I want to mention, remember, this isn't just for Medicare. We're talking about providers.
Honestly has nothing to do with
this.
Medicare.
This has to do with state law.
Okay, go.
Yeah, this is a state scope, state licensure issue.
Right. And we've been saying that a lot. If you remember in past episodes, we've talked about the collaboration agreement is for licensure purposes. It has nothing to do with how you get paid or your contracts for payment, but are you even allowed to do this and what's required? So like you were saying, Scott, if they're supposed to be reviewing those charts and you can't prove it, then you didn't do it. So there should be some sort of an email or a summary at the very least, and your compliance program should be included in that. That should be going directly back to your compliance officer who shares that information with HR, or, you know, you have a specific person that goes to, there's that accountability there. But what I wanted to share with you was things change. They change so much. So like Terry was saying earlier, I know in the state of Florida for decades, your nurse practitioners, physician assistants couldn't supervise medical assistants or those ancillary phlebotomists, things like that. And last year there was a change to that law that allowed nurse practitioners and physician assistants to provide that supervisory role for those particular ancillary staffs. And that's new. That's not something that was always there before. So again, going back to how important it is to have your compliance program, to make sure that everything is getting worked into that, those quarterly or monthly meetings that are happening, or even more depending on the size of your organization. Super, super important, guys. Things change.
Well, and I think that last point was very important, because we think about supervision and collaborative agreements between physicians and nurse practitioners and physician assistants. There's a lot of routine work that goes on within a physician practice, drawing of labs being one example, the actual performance of imaging. And, you know, we tend to assume, well, okay, these people are just doing their own thing in their own space. And, you know, the tech knows how to position, you know, my leg or whatever for this X-ray. But states have their own rules about who can supervise the performance of those duties. Mm-hmm. And you should not assume that because you have an office with 3 physicians and 6 nurse practitioners or PAs, that those nurse practitioners or physician assistants can actually supervise the performance of radiologic work, because that's not always the case.
I want to take it one step further, and then Stephanie, I'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. You should not deploy the incident to billing guidelines in this scenario. Incident two is specific to Medicare. Okay. What you need to be looking at are the state nursing practice acts for each and every single state. Now, I think it was Christine who brought this up. You know, this is a significant compliance issue. And I know Terry and I tomorrow are going to be talking about a section of the general compliance program guidance from the Office of Inspector General. And I'm very much looking forward to that episode, because I think there's a lot that we need to unpack. And I think we'll get to that, a little bit later. But listen, when it comes to your compliance programs, you need to have effective policies and procedures. You cannot overlook the fact that you need to have a policy on collaboration. It needs to be in there. And, you know, you can write a general purpose of the policy to say, you know, ABC Corporation or ABC Medical Practice is intending to comply with the state of New Mexico guidelines with respect to the State Nurse Practice Act. And then you need to go through there and you need to delineate between the responsibilities of a physician assistant versus a nurse practitioner, because again, they are inherently different in what each of these professionals, these healthcare professionals, can do. Let me pause there for a minute. And
Stephanie, I have a jump in real quick.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Just remember that if you're not doing something legal or allowed to by license, then you're not entitled to get paid for it. So that licensure, that legal, that's going to trump everything. It's the basis there. If you don't know what your laws are, your licensure, what your contracts state, you know, you run that risk there of having to return everything you got paid for because you didn't follow the law. You didn't follow the licensure. And I think that's really important to remember.
And if it's a violation of federal law for a federal payer, right? Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, VA, CHAMPIS, now you're dealing with civil monetary penalties law, CMPs, or CMPLs. So there are multipliers for those, and they could be double digits to treble damages depending on the direction it goes. All right. So Stephanie, go ahead, because I know you deal with this a lot, and we have a couple of clients that you and I are continuously having to talk about. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Because it's a violation of state law. So go ahead. Let me give that to you.
Okay. So I like these points being brought up because I have right now, actually, I'm dealing with a client where they have an entire department of a particular specialty where they're not understanding this on any level. And it's so messy right now. So when we think about the law side of things and separate it from the billing, you know, I think that's one of the key takeaways for today, because they're not one in the same. They don't cross over. Just because you have a collaboration does not mean you get to do whatever you want with the NP or the PA. So with the client that I'm dealing with right now, they have a situation where, first of all, they have a legal agreement in place. But when we look beyond that, the mid-level providers are technically employed by a different entity. So right there, we have a problem as they start to try to use them for billing purposes. And then on top of it, I also have a situation where physicians don't understand that they don't quote unquote own them. And they can't just have them do whatever in the office and then take over and bill for it. So right now, what they're trying to do is split shared services. And when we really dove in and talked through all of that, one physician got, you know, kind of upset with me, and she's like, well, she's a scribe. And I was like, scribing also doesn't work because she's performing the service. Yes. Yes. So this physician just sat there in the meeting with me the entire time, frustrated, saying, well, she's a scribe. She's a scribe. And I was like, I already know she's performing the portions of the service.
The problem is, and see, here's the other thing to keep in mind, okay? You can't call somebody a scribe if they're not truly a scribe. And, you know, people, I've had physicians say to me, well, how are they ever going to figure this out? Really? There's something called metadata that is retrievable from your EMR that shows who, when, and for how long, and at what specific intervals information was put into the system by your scribe. So, folks, listen, there's no circumventing the system on this. You have to remain compliant, because we're not just talking about possible violation of your contract that could lead to a revocation of your billing number. We're talking about the potential of violating state law that has either significant civil or potential criminal liability that you have to face. So, Scott, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. And then, Terry, I know you got something to say, too. Please.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, it's one of those things with scribes where usually my next conversation is, well, why would you pay this person this much money to function as a scribe, even if you're claiming
such a great point?
You know, I mean, I always say, like, we can go down to the job office and we can find a scribe, right? Like a scribe is just somebody who repeats what you say. And that can be anybody, like the person in the, you know, the court reporter obviously has to type really fast, is that fancy machine, but it's the same basic function, right? You don't think. And, you know, so I just wanted to make that point because I hear that all the time. And I'm constantly like Stephanie's point about the physician wanting to come in and do that one piece of the plan of care. You know, I can't tell you how many times I explain that that's not allowed. And it's like this disbelief, like, you know, like, really? No, you can't do it. Really? And these are important things because, you know, we talked a little bit about the impact on reimbursement. And Sean made the point, this impacts your livelihood. This impacts your medical license, potentially.
Go ahead, Terry.
So just on the scribe thing, and then I wanted to kind of just get back to something I read in the article that I think is important. One of the things on the scribe, so I audit for payers, and I've had providers say the same thing, Stephanie, that you ran into, and just say, well, then they're a scribe. I'm like, okay, can I have your scribe come in here? And they're just like, what are you talking about? I'm like, I want to see your nurse practitioner. And they just said, well, and I said, you might say you're a scribe, but I want to see what they would say under oath. So let's see. So they have them come in and nurse practitioner PA comes in. And I said, so do you not have any medical decision-making authority? And they just look at me and go, what do you mean? I said, so you're not going to give any input. You're just mimicking what the physician says. And basically you're being paid as a PA or nurse practitioner, but you're not even a medical assistant here.
It's insulting.
And
it's such a great point, right? Cause you picture that person on the stand and the lawyer's like, well, the doctor said you don't think at all.
Right. Yeah. That's what I said. I said, the doctor said you're a scribe, which means all you do is write down what the doctor said and you don't have any say in what goes on with that patient. I just want to make sure that's clear because my next call is going to be to the nursing board to make sure that you're over-credentialed. And they're just like, I mean, I get pretty belligerent about this because it makes me so angry that somebody would think that we would actually think as auditors, as consultants, as people who are trying to keep you protected. And I'm talking to our listeners and any providers that are listening here. We're trying to protect you. We're not trying to tell you what to do. We're trying to protect you of what's coming. And if you get a nurse practitioner, PA or clinical nurse specialist on the stand, do you really think they're going to say, I know nothing? I only mimic what the doctor says. I have no authority to do anything. And I would never treat a patient. No, that's just silly. To make $100,000.
A nurse practitioner who indicated that they were simply following the plan of care devised by the physician, and that's all they were doing, was just sentenced to 200 years in prison.
Okay? Yeah, I mean,
it's not a joke. 200 years.
You have to really be careful as a provider out there, as a physician, I should say, saying what you think your mid-level will say just to cover your butt. That's not okay. You can't do that. But let me go before I get on a tangent here because I could get real hot about this. I won't.
I want to say one other thing, though.
Okay.
You know, to Terry's point, you know, Terry gets to perform audits on behalf of insurance companies, federal payers, commercial payers. I'm an investigator for a composite medical board. So when the special investigative units of the commercial payers believe that there's activity going on at a medical practice, at a hospital, within a health system, where they've conducted their own independent, hopefully objective investigation of that entity, they create an SIU package and it will come over to the composite medical board. And as the investigator, they will send it to me. To Terry's point, and I will tell you, I do the exact same thing. I will read everything that is in the SIU packet. And then I will start with the top of the food chain, which is the provider. And I will get the provider side of the story. And I want people to understand this. My job is to advocate at the composite medical board. Even though I'm an investigator, my job is to advocate on behalf of clinicians, on behalf of physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, nurses, right? That's my job, is to advocate. But if I start off by talking to the physician and the physician says to me, this is what I do, A, B, and C, and they are definitive with that. And they, you know, they take this position of, I've done no wrong. You can't prove anything. And then all of a sudden I said, well, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. I immediately discontinue the call with the provider. I thank them very much. I disconnect the call, and then I call the practice straight back, and I ask to speak to either a PA or a nurse practitioner before I ever give the physician an opportunity to go and tell them, hey, here's what I said to this investigator. They don't get that opportunity. I call back immediately and I get them on the phone. And now if all of a sudden there are competing stories, now I know that I have a problem. And I try to tell people all the time, these two things on the side of my head, they're not ears, they're human BS detectors. I've been doing this for a long time. And I know when somebody's lying, right? And I tell people all the time, you can't BS a BSer. All right. So folks, please.
Wait a minute. Don't you ever hear? But everybody else does it, Sean. Let's just be realistic. Yeah, nobody's just doing this. They're all doing that.
And what I would say to that is stop it.
Yeah.
Because there's two things that the government prosecutes for. Okay. There's deliberate ignorance and reckless disregard. Yeah. Okay. Now, knowing is another thing. And I'm talking about the Civil False Claims Act. We're not even talking about the healthcare fraud statute, right?
Well, and the other thing is too, is as I'm auditing for payers, remember I went into auditing for payers 20 years ago because I felt like physicians were getting a bad rap when I was asked by one of the big payers. I was just like, and then it kind of stemmed from there. And, you know, a couple of the MAC payers in the government, I was like, yeah, you know, I do want to do that because I think the providers are not really being heard here.
Yeah.
And I'm probably 80% correct, but it's that 20%. Oh my gosh, I bang my head over. And it's these kinds of conversations. Well, we'll just call it this. I mean, just taking it a step further, you know, first of all, an NP and PA, they work very hard for their credentials.
Absolutely.
And what they're allowed to do as mid-levels. They're not going to lie and say, yeah, I'm a scribe. I mean, they're just not. And the next thing is that we have RNs that doctors are saying they're actually a nurse practitioner because they've worked here for 10, 20 years. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Stephanie's like, oh yes. And you know, that's a problem too. When I did an audit on that years ago, they're just like, yeah, but again, you know, Sean and I have this conversation every once in a while. And I'm like, so basically you're saying you're not that, you just play one on TV. That's the same thing using an RN as an NP. Don't do it. You know, you have to know what they do. But let me just get to the collaborative agreement back. And then I know Scott has some more to add to this. So one of the things that came up, it was an OB-GYN and nurse practitioner. And it looked like, and the DA got involved. So this was a really huge, huge deal. It was California, Massachusetts. And the physician, basically it said, Skim signed and returned the collaborative agreement. So really didn't look at it, just signed it, which I know a lot of us do that, or I should say a lot of you do that. And then they sent it out there. I don't want to be accusatory. And then the doctor went to go practice somewhere in Massachusetts, but the nurse practitioner stayed in California. Well, the problem was in California, when you give authoritative control to controlled substance prescription authority, you actually have to list everything that you're allowing them to do. Well, that wasn't there. It wasn't identified. It was very generic. It wasn't there. And it's, and I'm reading from the article, it says that the nurse practitioner prescribed anabolic steroids to male patients, which they had no experience to do so. And it wasn't listed on the collaborative agreement. And then the other thing was they also in their agreement, it was not only careless, but it said that they were trying to bill for, or they were trying to do something that talked about a supervision where she was doing an independent practice, but you have to have a physician within a certain 50-mile radius in California. So you can have independent as a nurse practitioner. It's different as a PA here, but nurse practitioner, but your doctor that you're collaborating with or supervising you as a whole has to be within a 50-mile radius. Massachusetts and California are not a 50-mile radius, in case you've ever looked at a map. The other thing is, and this was actually something that I didn't even think of when we were talking about, you know, once it's ended, you have to end them. There's some issues right now with telehealth, where you're seeing patients crossing state lines. Even if you're in part of that co-op or whatever they're allowing you to do, you have to know what that state, how many times does Christine have to say this to you? You have to know what that state is saying for to be able to treat in that state, and you have to be licensed in that state. And I've had two physicians right now say that they're on review to lose their possible license or be suspended because they, in their collaborative agreement, basically allowed their mid-level providers to do telehealth cross state lines. They were not licensed in those states. And those states are like, no, you can't do that here. One was Florida, one was New York. And, you know, they were coming from the West Coast and Arizona. And they're just like, but we didn't know. And to Sean's point, ignorance is not bliss here. It's more not bliss than anything. And I mean, I could just go on, but it just, there's some states that require every single note to be reviewed. There's some states that want 10%, 10 charts per this, some that want, you know, 50% as we have here in California. It just, you have to know what your state says. And if you're treating outside your state, what is that provider doing under that agreement, and make sure that it, you know, it's very detailed. So Scott, go ahead.
I think it's, sorry, Scott, but there's one thing we're missing here is as providers say, I didn't know. Think about all the things in life that you've got to know. You've got to know how you're getting paid. You've got to know how much taxes are being taken out. You've got to know, you know, what are the rules of banking? You've got to know that things have to be, these things you have to know. And if you don't, there are serious consequences. This is no different than anything else in life. You've got to know.
Yeah, I mean, when I was young and irresponsible, arguably now I'm just old and irresponsible, but when I was young and irresponsible, my old man used to point out to me how magically whenever something was important to me, it got done. And it was always the things that didn't seem to be important to me at the time that didn't get done. And when you're talking about your medical license, understanding the rules under which you obtained it and you're using it, I think falls into that important list. The point I wanted to make is, you know, Sean had talked earlier about metadata and how it's very difficult in the current world we live in to function without leaving like an extensive digital footprint, whether it involves the time that you're saying you're doing things or things of that nature. And, you know, a lot of the things that we're talking about probably feel in some instances like they're relatively small things, or they might be things that are hard to discover. You know, Sean and I have been involved in a number of cases, Sean probably 10 times more than I have, where some investigator has gone down a long and winding road based on an erroneous interpretation of metadata, or they find something that they think is wrong and they're insistent on proving it's wrong. And, you know, the net result of that, for better or for worse, is they're going to be rifling deeply through your data and through your metadata. And, you know, the old saying, even the blind mouse gets the cheese once in a while. And so, you know, when you're creating these records and you have this list of things that you're doing or not doing with regard to collaboration agreements or what your PA is doing versus thinking they're doing, or your RN is somehow practicing medicine, these things may come to the surface at the wrong time. And, you know, Sean had mentioned someone going to prison for this. These things go beyond having to return a stray payment here or there, right? Like, what, you know, we talk about people on the stand and what they're confronted with. You know, how'd you like to be the patient that finds out that the RN is the one who described or documented like your treatment regimen for a serious illness and something went awry, right? So these are serious issues. And when they come to the surface, have the potential to be devastating to your professional livelihood, frankly.
And remember, you know, these issues, you know, while they could be considered malpractice, some of these could actually rise to the level of criminal prosecution if somebody suffers loss of bodily function or, you know, body part, or worse, their life. So, folks, I think we'll wrap this part up of the discussion by saying, understand what can and cannot be performed legally in your state. Don't try to use Medicare as the standard for what nurse practitioners and PAs or other ancillary support staff members can do. Rely on the State Practice Act. And if you are not familiar with it, if you have questions or concerns, reach out to the advocate for the state nurse practice, you know, for the State Nursing Association, or reach out to an attorney who can help you understand this, who has the requisite skills in healthcare to be able to explain this to you in an effective and easy to understand way. All right, let's jump topics and move into talking about CERT. If you are not familiar with CERT, that is the Comprehensive Error Rate Testing. It is something that has been around for a long time. CERT is becoming more and more prevalent in federal cases. In the last year, in 2023, I was a part of a total of 50 civil and criminal cases. I only testified in 10 last year. I shouldn't say only. It was a ridiculous amount. And I will tell you, the CERT studies that were introduced played vital and critical roles, both either on the prosecution side to show that this is a problem that a provider should have been aware of, or on the defense side for saying, hey, this is a widespread problem. Yes, but it's a widespread problem because there's a lack of education provided by the federal government. So there are arguments on both sides. It just depends who's the better storyteller, the prosecutor prosecuting the case or the criminal defense attorney defending the person being prosecuted. So who wants to go ahead and take this one out of the gate, and we can talk about the increase in the error rate. And then as a final thought, I will tell you what I do and what we do here at Doctors Management when a client or a potential client reaches out to us and says, hey, I just received a letter from a CERT. What do I do?
So I'll start it just because it came up on that report that I was looking at. So CERT, again, what Sean said, comprehensive error rate testing, basically it's statistical information. So it's random, you know, the Medicare payer, CMS, they're looking at things based on trends. And so basically they're looking at volumes and things that are not, I don't want to say copacetic, but that are different, that are outliers, let's say. And they take a lot of this information and basically they put it into their system and then they spit it out and say, okay, here's where some problems exist. And then they take a look at it. So the report was actually kind of interesting. It said the overall improper payment rate for Medicare claims dropped less than 1% in a recent review for 2023. The review period was June 30th of 2022 through, I think it was through July. It was through 2020 through June 30th. But one thing that I thought was interesting is they said, however, there was an increase on a particular claim set, and that is the 99442 and 443, which are the audio-only phone call codes, of over 8% error rate. And they said the biggest issues were two things. They said medical necessity, that they couldn't conclude that it was even necessary to do these services. Okay, so that was one thing. But the other thing, and I get this all the time, I get it not just with phone calls, I get it with office visits, I get it with conscious sedation, where the physician will put, I spent 11 to 20 minutes with the patient. They put the code range that's in the CPT descriptor instead of the exact time spent. Remember, CPT is for your direction. Basically, it's like reading directions, and then you use it based on what you did. You have to be exact. You can't use that that time frame saying, well, as long as I put 11 to 20, I've met the 11 to 20 minute code. No, you would have to say I spent 14 minutes and what you did with that. But the biggest issue here is the fact that we still have providers that are billing for phone call codes because they get paid for routine test results, for calling the patient, how are you doing? You know, just checking in on you. No, you can't do that. Remember that they are in the E&M section. They are basically, they were opened up 4 years ago now, people. They were opened up 4 years ago during the height of the pandemic for patients who didn't have strong internet, who couldn't get on an audio video, where the office maybe didn't even have telehealth audio and video available. The patient didn't have a phone that allowed that. And it was a way to allow patients to have a physician connection through audio only means because we were in a pandemic. There was a reason they opened that up. But now you've got, I would say it's up to almost 60%, just based on what I've seen, as far as commercial plans not paying for that. Many plans already put out saying, we're not paying for that anymore. We've seen too many issues with that. We want you either back in the office or audio and video. Medicare is auditing them every second. All I'm seeing is denial, denial, denial. Medicaid, oh my gosh, if you don't put on your Medicaid, depending on what state you're in, but I know in California, Medi-Cal, they're basically saying, did you document why they couldn't be seen in person or audio only? And did you tell them this is the only option they have? If so, you're in so much trouble. Just wait till we get after you. So audio only, this is the last resort. This is not a routine visit. This is not something you can tell a patient when they're in the office for a visit. Okay, we're going to schedule you for an audio only follow-up. No, that's not what that's for. And it has to actually replicate as close as possible an E&M service of either in-person or audio and video, because your payment parity is still there through the end of the year. So be clear what I'm telling you here. Yes, they're still valid as far as being reimbursed, but not for everything that you think you can do. There still is, no matter what, a medical necessity issue, but is it really necessary to be able to do it? So medical necessity and medically necessary, that's what I always look at. It can't be something that the patient was already here, you know, a week before and said within a week, and they just called back to get a clarification on their meds. You can't charge for that. Or again, they're just getting a test result. You already got credit in your E&M for ordering that test. So those are the kinds of things that I'm seeing that are being refunded now. Now there's refunding being requests. It's always on the OIG work plan. But the fact that it came up on the CERT audit, that's a bad thing. That means it's just being looked at random now. And it's not just being looked at for documentation. It's being looked at for volume, for, you know, overutilization. And that means it's when you get a letter. So Christine, take it away.
Thanks. You're 1,000% right, Terry. I see this all the time where providers will say, but they pay me for it. So if I couldn't do it, why would they pay me? Listen, there are not those types of edits in place. And when you submit a claim, you're only submitting your diagnosis code and you're submitting the CPT code. So from a payer's perspective, if you're putting down hypertension, diabetes, whatever it happens to be, the payer is assuming that this was medically necessary to do this over the telephone for treatment of these following conditions. They
you
don't
know. Let me interrupt you real quick. One of the things that the people just be Rick and I want to send it back to you. Don't always think just because you get paid, that was what makes it accurate. Because remember, we are subject matter experts. I can get you paid for a spare tire to a medical insurance company. I can get you paid for anything. You name it, I could get you paid for it. But should I? No, no. That's all I'm
are
saying.
You entitled to keep
there are
money.
Things that you can't, you shouldn't be submitting claims for. And, you know, there are things you could slide through any payer, but that doesn't mean you should. Okay, sorry. I had to say that.
No, you're spot on, because that is absolutely the nail on the head, the hammer on the nail. I don't know how that goes. Anyway, just because they pay you doesn't mean you're entitled to it. Doesn't mean that you told the story correctly. Doesn't mean you said, I was just calling to give them their lab results back that I got credit for in the E&M visit. That's not what you communicated on the claim form. Remember that. The claim form is how you're communicating what it is that you did for that patient today. And if that is not medically necessary, if you're not treating, you're not evaluating and managing that particular condition, that's lying. And it's double dipping. And I know no one likes that word, but that's the truth. You're getting paid extra for something that you're not entitled to. And so this is huge in my opinion. And I did notice that a lot of the commercial payers at the first of the year when the policies came out, because I read them, the 47, 87 pages of those policies, they're not covering telephone visits at all. And that's causing a backlog of denials. It's causing a backlog for your AR. It's really causing a problem, folks, because you're not taking the time to really report these correctly. And now CERT's involved, and CERT is telling us, the OIG has been telling us, how many people need to get involved before we start realizing that just because we got paid doesn't mean that we got paid correctly, and we need to pay that money back and stop this.
And one thing too, to add to that, you know, this is not the answer to budget problems inside of the practices. You know, this is not a revenue maker. This is not supposed to be there. We saw a lot of that during COVID, right? You know, everybody had a brand new business idea, but it's still continuing. I'm still seeing that this is happening with people. And, you know, it's even getting to the point where now, like Terry said, we're 4 years after the fact And I still, as of last week or the week before, am doing audits where everything shows it's audio only. There's no time documented, and they build it with an established patient and a 95 modifier. So we have, you know, a lot of issues that exist that are driving, you know, all of these different investigations and audits to have to occur, because people are just thinking, oh, they'll pay for it, we can do it, and it'll help our bottom line.
I had a conversation, and this came up. This wasn't even the question I was asking, but I can't remember exactly how it came up. But I had a conversation with a practice scheduler, and she was just talking about the different things that she does. And she said, oh, well, I have a note in my thing not to schedule the phone follow-ups until the 8th day after the last visit, because otherwise I don't get paid. And, you know, I think some of that was just in how people interpret and relate to policies and practices, but obviously that's not a very wise approach. And, you know, I'm not surprised at all that Terry brought this up, because I can't tell you how many times I see, you know, phone visits where I think, as Stephanie said, there's either no time in the visit or there's some range of time, right? Like, oh, this is, I'm going to put 99442 parenthetically 11 through 20 minutes. And it just landed somewhere in that range. And these are time-based services where there should be precision in the documentation, and there should be a clear rationale why you're doing it this way. And frankly, I see some of the things that I'm sure everybody else sees. The note where it's a 99214, and you open the note and it says, well, you know, we couldn't establish a connection, so I gave the patient a call. And so, you know, we know it's a phone-only visit, but the provider has convinced him or herself, or somehow they've interpreted the policy that means if we made a good faith effort to get on video, then we could still do it as though it were video. But that's not the way the policy works. And so, you know, I think that, as everybody else has said, there's a storm cloud of overutilization and improper billing of these codes that's coming down the pike, you know. And so when you ask us as subject matter experts why we react the way we do to, say, like G2211, the inherent complexity visit, it's because you see the same thing coming down the path in a slightly different way. Like, here's a thing that's got a set of rules around it. It's intended for certain circumstances, and it's going to start getting stamped into all these different things in all these different ways. And so it is important, because, you know, if you relate this back to G2211, this 99442 and the phone coding is just further along the spectrum of our work, right? We have entered the phase of recoupment. And that phase is going to go on, and some, you know, some physician practices, probably many, are going to find themselves sending back a chunk of money because of their misapplication of these policies. And so, you know, I did want to bring that up, because I think it's important when we try to proactively talk about getting policies and procedures in place for new codes or things we may not see in policies. We talked about chaperones and the use of 99459. It all does sort of relate in this way, right? Like, you know, it's you know, the cert of tomorrow today, right? So now we've reached phone codes being on a cert report, and there's going to be a lot of scrutiny of these codes. And frankly, from everything I see in the audit work that I do, you know, there's going to be quite a bit of money flowing back.
And I'm seeing money flow back. You don't see it for something you did 6 months ago. You see it for years ago. And right now, I'm knee deep in recoupment of COVID during COVID dates of service for services that were reported incorrectly. And you can argue that, you know, it was kind of chaotic at that moment, but we were given guidance. As the new guidance came out, we need to be able to show that we were receiving that guidance and making changes accordingly, right? You just can't say, I didn't know. We've talked about that before, but we're seeing things being recouped from years ago. So what we're talking about today with these telephones, we're going to be recouping money that you received 4 years ago for telephone visits. You may not even have that liquid to pay back at this moment. Think about those types of situations.
I will say this. We are seeing significant clawbacks right now from BCBS. With respect to evaluation and management services being performed on the same day as a COVID screen. Again, we're going back to the very beginning of the public health emergency. And the guidance that I have seen BCBS rely on was guidance that was changed within a couple of weeks by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to where they had to give more clarification. And, you know, I had one insurance company was saying, well, they shouldn't have billed anything higher than a 99211 if they were doing COVID testing. And we had to go back into the note, and they said, well, you know, CMS said blah, blah, blah. And we had to go back into the note to say, this is what the actual guidance said. Okay. And you actually have at these testing facilities, PAs, nurse practitioners. I think we all remember, you know, a couple of months into the public health emergency where these tents were being set up outside of the providers' facilities, outside of the hospitals, where you had a nurse practitioner. It wasn't just a medical assistant sticking a swab in somebody's brain to get a sample. It was a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. And often, I know, Scott, one of our clients actually had the audio video set up, the computer, so that the physician could be on the computer as these evaluations were being done. And we've had to go back to the insurance companies. Aetna was a big one. We had a clawback for almost $1.2 million, Stephanie, if you remember, for one of our clients in Illinois. And we had to go back to them and say, absolutely not. This was not just a COVID swab. This was a full evaluation brought by a licensed clinical individual, a nurse practitioner or PA, who listened to the heart and lungs, who evaluated the patient, who prescribed medication for the patient or prescribed an over-the-counter treatment, and said, oh, by the way, let's go ahead and get that COVID swab because you are showing all the symptoms or signs. These weren't just situations where you had somebody randomly pull in and go, hey, I think I was exposed to somebody who had COVID and I just want to get a swab, right? That's when it should have been just the COVID swab, the screen. But there's a lot of this stuff going on right now, and you've got to be aware of this. This is why we talk about the critical importance of documentation, because God forbid, if you have to rely on somebody like myself to go into the courtroom to help to defend what is documented in the medical records, you better have clear, concise, accurate, and complete documentation. Otherwise, we're rowing up the river against the current, and it's not what we want to do. You know, the last thing that I would say is this, you know, and I always go back to this, deliberate ignorance is not an excuse. It's indefensible. If you should have known, or you could have known, then you should have. Now,
well, the other thing you have to keep in mind too, is I think, and I get doctors saying this all the time, especially when they do incidental services that are not needed. I have some practices that like to do EKGs every time a patient walks in the door, but they don't have a symptom. They don't have a reason to do it. They don't have a diagnosis that warrants it. They just said, well, I always do it.
It's good medicine.
I'm a cardiologist. I'm like, no, that's like every time they walk in, taking a strep test, or every time they walk in doing a blood test. You can't go fishing. Okay. There has to be a reason to do it. It has to be medically indicated. So one of the things I had a doctor tell me, he's like, well, they're not going to come after me for a $13 test. Okay. One of the things you have to know about CMS and OIG and HHS and everything, first of all, they look at a universe of claims based on a small percentage of what you've done. So if they see that you have, you know, done something with 30 claims, they will say, okay, based on that, our extrapolation is going to be this. They don't sit there and say, okay, well, then send me a 1500 claim so we can expand it. They will maybe expand, but I'm just saying that there's not, and Sean, I'm sure you could speak to this. Yeah. There's not a number small enough that won't be on the radar.
Let me put this into definitive terms. Okay. Yeah. Of the 15, 16 cases that I have already this year that are all criminal federal cases, okay? Every single one of them has an extrapolation where the government said, these are the six patients that we are using for the indictment. Patient JJ, AA, BB, CC, DD, okay? And our determination for damages that the federal government has suffered based on these six patients is $2 million, is $140 million. I mean, the amounts are astronomical. Listen, folks, I was the key defense expert in United States v. Bothra Lewis et al., which was a $480 million case that the federal government was seeking remunerations on. And yeah, Dr. Bothra and Dr. Lewis and the others that were co-defendants in this or co-conspirators, according to the government, were all acquitted at trial, 54 counts each. But to Terry's point, it doesn't matter if it was a $3 test or if it was a $3,000 test. They're going to look for detectable patterns, and then they will make determinations based on your patient universe. They will use extrapolation methodologies. And then if you're dealing with a UPIC right now, you'll find UPICs that are actually saying, we went one step further than a post-audit extrapolation. We actually had a statistician do a Monte Carlo simulation to verify our findings were correct. Now, there's a whole argument about Monte Carlo simulations, and that's for another daily dose if I ever get time to be able to go back to doing those, and why a Monte Carlo simulation is a waste of time. But anyways, if you receive a cert letter, and then Christine, I'm going to give you the last word on this. What I typically do is I encourage my clients to do a self-audit. Make a determination as to whether there is any there to the fact that, remember, you get a cert letter when cert determines that you are an outlier. You get a cert letter when they believe that there's an aberrance to your coding patterns. They're not just sending you one saying, hey, we've determined that there's a whole bunch of bad actors out there or potential bad actors that are doing things wrong. No, this is a targeted letter to you. That's why I say all the time, it's crazy that you don't know what your own numbers show, because the government knows exactly what your numbers show. So we encourage our clients, when you receive a cert letter, to do your own random sample. Doesn't have to be statistically valid. It could be a non-probability sample or a convenience sample. Audit it. Determine whether or not there's a problem. And if there is, you know, follow Section 6204 of the Act and make your voluntary refunds if it's within 12 months, or do your corrected claims. If you find that there are no problems, that you had an independent third party review your claims, excuse me, and your documentation, and they said everything is in accordance with, you know, generally accepted standards of medical practice. It complies with the LCDs, the LCAs, the medical coverage policies, whatever it is. I always write a letter on behalf of our client that goes back to CERT to say, we appreciate the heads up and you notifying us that our provider or providers are showing as outliers in your system. An independent third-party evaluation of their documentation has been performed, which include a random sample of claims in accordance with what would be considered appropriate under GAAP, guidelines, general accounting principle, generally accepted accounting principles. And there's not been a detectable pattern or any issues identified. As part of our corporate compliance program, we thank you for this notification. Folks, please remember this, and this is the last thing that I'm going to say. A letter from the CERT is a shot across the bow. It's a warning shot. It is a warning shot that says, hey, we're right here. We're watching you. And at any moment, we could board your vessel. All right, go ahead, Christine, please.
Well, I wanted to shed something a little bit lighter to this. It's not that we're saying providers, You're not entitled to get paid for what it is that you do for your patients. You're not entitled to practice good medicine. We believe in good medicine. And there's a lot of great legislation out there. The Affordable Care Act opened up all kinds of preventive services that are encouraged for patients. But you have to know what is a payer's responsibility to pay. I often say medical necessity is part of the sentence. The full sentence is, was it medically necessary for that payer to pay the bill, right? So from both sides of that, I get it that you want to provide good services for your patients, but you also need to follow those guidelines that are built into the contracts of what payers are going to pay. That's a very important relationship if we want to be able to continue to have coverages that will pay for patients, continue to allow patients to come in and receive healthcare. We've all got to make sure that we're working within those appropriate payment guidelines there. So that's all I wanted to add on the tail end of it is we love that providers are out there taking care of us. But remember, payment for those services is really going to be based on what those policies hold and what our contracts say we're allowed to get paid for.
Yeah. And I would just say, like, you know, with regard to outliers, sometimes you're an outlier for a very valid reason. Like you might practice somewhere where there's a large population of elderly patients or something like that. But, you know, any service, regardless of the value, is going to be a high value service if done at a significant volume. And I hate to sound like Captain Obvious here, but when you're doing something a lot, it's somewhat important that you know how to do it correctly. Like I can't tell you how many times I do not support smoking cessation, that 99406 code for 3 minutes of smoking cessation counseling that pays a very modest amount of money, but it has certain documentation guidelines behind it with regard to like specifically how you're helping the patient quit smoking versus just saying, well, I told the patient for 3 minutes to not smoke. And then somewhere else in the note, the patient's like, well, I'll never quit smoking, by the way. And you know that if you're doing that a lot, like it's going to have a high value and it's going to sit there. You know, like people lose, you know, thousands of dollars on penny slot machines, right? Like it's a small amount, but it's going to keep adding up the more times you're doing it wrong.
My wife would be one of those. Okay. I'm going to end right there before I say something else to incriminate myself. I have already sang Julio Iglesias songs. I've insulted my wife who plays the penny slots, and she will remind me that she did win $1,800, but I explained to her that it cost her $4,000 to win $1,800. So with that said, I would like to thank Terry Fletcher, Scott Kraft, Christine Hall, Stephanie Howard for being on the podcast today. Terry and I are going to be back tomorrow talking about the general compliance program guidance from the Office of the Inspector General. Christine actually gave us a great segue into the discussion about medical necessity tomorrow. And really, what does medical necessity mean? Who should be evaluating for medical necessity and much more. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media at The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.